Back together again, you and I right here, wrapping up a busy week with a very busy show, Friday style, October 24th, 2025 on Connecticut Today. I opened the show looking at the latest absentee ballot allegations against an embattled member of the Bridgeport City Council. Former Bridgeport Democratic State Rep. Chris Caruso dropped by with his weekly update and his thoughts as well on those latest absentee ballot rumblings in Bridgeport. State Senate Republican leader Steve Harding joined the show to talk about rumors of a resurrected housing bill for an upcoming General Assembly special session next month. Sacred Heart University sports management professor Dr. Josh Short offered his thoughts on the current betting scandals connected to the National Basketball Association. CBS News White House reporter Willie James Inman checked in with us for an update on the latest developments connected to the ongoing government shutdown. Finally, on United Nations Day, we welcomed Thant Minh U, author of Peacemaker U Thant and the Forgotten Quest for a Just World.
Well, it happens again and again and again and again. It never, ever stops in Bridgeport. I don't know whether to laugh or cry. No, honestly, and I'm not saying that for effect. I don't know whether to laugh or cry. Because just when you think, okay, maybe it's calmed down, maybe it's good to settle away. No, it never does. You heard Chris's story there in the news at the top, and it's all over the state. This version, Andrew Brown's version in the Connecticut Mirror. State prosecutors investigating a Bridgeport City Councilman again. It never ends. It never, ever, 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 ever ends. You know what? It's because of stuff like this that I would much rather reside outside Bridgeport. Don't get me wrong. Wonderful city, great city to do stuff. I mean, the Amp and going to a Sound Tigers game and taking advantage of the Bridgeport shoreline and that's not the issue. The issue here is this never ends. And I know there are allegations, and I know innocent until proven guilty, but the bottom line is, it never, ever, 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 ever ends. State officials are once again investigating Bridgeport City Councilor Alfredo Castillo for allegedly collecting absentee ballots from public housing facilities ahead of the city's general election next month. It is mind-numbing. Mind-numbing. And yet, legislative Democrats in Hartford won't do anything about it. Because I guess they're okay with it. What else can it be? The State Elections Enforcement Commission voted this week to refer two recent complaints about Castillo to state prosecutors for potential criminal charges. Now, again, I fully understand innocent till proven guilty. I get it. I understand it. But why does this stuff continue to pop up? Rhetorical question. And why? And I know the Secretary of the State's office, it was in the papers the other day, they're spending $55,000 on voter education in Bridgeport. Whoop-de-doo. That's good. It can only help. But when the Democrats in the legislature a few months ago had the chance to do something with some teeth in it regarding absentee ballots, they didn't do it. I wonder why, he said, perhaps rhetorically. Wink, wink. The latest complaints were filed by Jasmine Cooper, who was the daughter of Bridgeport City Councilwoman Inida Martinez. They accused Castillo and three other political operatives of manipulating voters and illegally taking possession of, drumroll please, absentee ballots, which is already a felony in Connecticut. I'm just reading what's here, folks. That's it. Now, again, this happens over and over and over and over and over again, and nothing does any. Nobody does anything about it. Cooper, who's deeply involved in Bridgeport politics, accused Castillo of taking possession of a voter's absentee ballot at the, well, here's a shock, the Crescent Crossings Housing Project, once again, and she alleged that she personally saw Castillo stuff several absentee ballots into the front pocket of his hooded sweatshirt at the Harborview Towers, another public housing facility, back on the 11th of October. Quote, I personally watched and recorded Alfredo stuff ballots in his sweater, Cooper wrote. He then disposed of them and came back at night to finish the job of harvesting ballots from voters. Ballot harvesting is illegal in the state of Connecticut. Yet we hear allegations of it happening over and over and over and over again, and no one does any damn thing about it. Quoting again from this story in the Connecticut Mirror, I'm not making this up. This is one of the versions of this story. Cooper then wrote, quote, he was going to units and sending them down to their mailbox. See, listen to this. He was going to units. This is a serious allegation, folks. He was going to units and sending them, I guess he means people, she means people from the units here, down to their mailbox to retrieve their ballots, have them sign, and he did the rest. Yikes. 203-333-9422-333-WICC. I understand these are allegations, but come on. Innocent till proven guilty, I get it. Now, Cooper also accused Castillo, who previously worked for the Park City Communities, Bridgeport Public Housing Authority, of using an old badge in order to gain access to the public housing facilities and the residents. Wow. One complaint said the following, quote, Alfredo Castillo has been using his housing authority HUD badge from years ago and using it to impersonate a HUD worker. Wow. Now, there's more to this story, but let me ask you this. We've already got calls coming in. Oh, man. This is my question of the day. 203-333-9422-333-WICC. Very simple question. Will Bridgeport ever shed its reputation of corruption in government? When does this end? Seriously, will Bridgeport ever shed its reputation of corruption in government? I don't know. You tell me. Hey, and maybe if it doesn't, I still got show prep for the next 50 years from the land where it never ends. It never, ever, 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 ever. It never ends. State prosecutors, this is not me. We're not making any of this up. Don't say, well, it's you people are stirring the pot. No, state prosecutors are investigating a Bridgeport councilman again. This is Alfredo Castillo, you know, who was already in trouble on a couple of other things. And the State Elections Enforcement Commission voting earlier this week to refer two recent complaints about Castillo to prosecutors for potential charges. But here's my point. Why is this stuff be it severe or not, when is this garbage going to end with the absentee ballots? It's ridiculous. You don't need to use as many absentee ballots in the city of Bridgeport that you're using. The numbers are ridiculous. Not that percentage of people is, there aren't that many people who are confined to walkers and wheelchairs in this city. The numbers aren't close in any other city or town. The complaints filed by Jasmine Cooper, the daughter of Bridgeport City Councilwoman Anita Martinez, they accuse Castillo and three other operatives of manipulating voters and illegally taking possession of absentee ballots, which is a felony in Connecticut. Yeah, we know it's a felony. Does anything ever happen? Cooper also accusing Castillo, who used to work for Park City Communities, Bridgeport's public housing authority, of using an old badge. This is the accusation here again, innocent until proven guilty, of using an old badge to get access to the public housing facilities and its residents. Meantime, some of the other political operatives whom Cooper accused of assisting Castillo are denying they ever interacted with voters at the Crescent Crossings and Harborview Towers. Tony Barr, who was the chairman of the Bridgeport New Movement Party, said he did go to Harborview Towers, but he said it was to meet up with a friend. And Wilfredo Martinez, chair of the Bridgeport Independent Party, who's running for a city council seat, said he had never even been to the Crescent Crossings property. Yada, yada, yada. This is, you people in Bridgeport, I mean you good people in Bridgeport, this is just ridiculous. Every election cycle, every stinking election cycle, how embarrassing. My God, get out if you can. Seriously, run. And again, the Democrats in Hartford, the majority in Hartford, had an opportunity to pass a really tough law a few months ago, and they refused to do it. 203-333-9422, 333-WICC. Supposedly, there was this bipartisan law that was all set that would have really come down like a ton of bricks on people who screwed around with absentee ballots. And if you were caught with doing any funny business with the ballots, it was going to be whatever the court said, plus 12 years worth of not being able to touch the absentee ballots. Ridiculous. The political culture in Bridgeport, it's mind-boggling. Look, I've covered stuff back when I was a reporter. I covered stuff in East Haven and New Haven and West Haven and Hamden and North Haven. Those towns, and yeah, they had some hiccups. Those towns are nirvana compared to here. And again, I'm not impugning the character of the good people of Bridgeport. The people who probably hear me talk about this, hear Melissa talk about this, hear Lisa talk about this, read this stuff in the Post and in the Connecticut Mirror and in onlyinbridgeport.com and in a bunch of places and just shake their heads. And here's the big question. How do you get rid of or clean up this culture of every single cycle? The rumblings, and you mentioned the words absentee ballots in Bridgeport, and eyes roll. People are like, yeah, when did this number of absentee ballots in Bridgeport become the norm? It's not the norm in any other city or town in the state. That's not just me saying it. The Connecticut Mirror did a very detailed breakdown almost a year ago. I think it was December of 2024. And they did a breakdown of the percentages seen in cities and towns regarding absentee ballots. Most cities and towns you saw 5%, 4%, 11%, 12%, and then Bridgeport, 24%, 23%. It's ridiculous. It's mind-numbing. There cannot be that many infirmed people in Bridgeport who need to vote absentee. And the more people that use absentee ballots that don't have to, they're just fortifying this sleaze. I'm sorry they are. And the only way it's going to stop if enough people who know they can get up and get out and go to the polling place themselves, if enough people say no, if somebody comes up and says, hey, can I get you an absentee ballot? You got to tell them no, no. My daughter or my son will take me, or I'll take the bus, or I'll get a ride, or whatever. No, because if you don't do that, none of this ever changes. But hey, maybe this is what people want. Hey, Bridgeport, how we doing? And we conduct our weekly check of the Stunads and the Cavones out there with our guy. For he's got his antenna up for them. Former Democratic State Rep. Chris Caruso, who I know gets incensed and gets agita about the same things I do. Mr. Caruso, good afternoon, sir. How are you?
Happy Friday, Paul. And first, let me just thank you for being the honorary Grand Marshal for the Columbus Day Parade.
Yeah.
And it was an honor, and I enjoyed our conversation at Nick's Diner in the North End right before the parade. We had a lot of fun. It was a great day to be Italian, Paul.
It certainly was. It was. It was, Chris. Thank you. And I got to go. Now that I know that it's there, I got to go by and mange a little bit. That's a nice place there. You know. Hey, Chris.
You know, Paul, the four brothers run it, and they've done a great job, and they're very into the community. So I encourage people to go up and support them.
Yep. Hey, Chris, couple of things here. And I know you had a chat with a leading progressive in the General Assembly, and I'm glad you told me that because I want to get your impressions of him. Before that, Chris, again, another day here, as my mother used to say, not throwed over and over again. We get, and again, Mr. Castillo, innocent until proven guilty. I get it. I understand that. But, Chris, I took so many calls today, and people are like, when is this ever going to end? And we're talking about more allegations, Chris, of something that is well known to be illegal, and that's ballot harvesting. Yet it continues, at least allegedly, to go on.
Well, it will stop, Paul, as we've said right along, when those that are convicted of abusing absentee ballots serve jail time. It's as simple as that. You know, a jury, you know, would have to convict them, and then the judge would have to demand that they serve jail time. It's the only way it's going to stop. And the gentleman in question, of course, it's alleged, these accusations, but he's been involved in a series of absentee ballot abuse. Time and time again, he's either being indicted or he's being investigated by the state's attorney's office. And it just continues. And in this case, allegedly, he declared that he was an employee of the Housing and Urban Development for the federal government.
Yeah.
And in one case, apparently, from my reading, he's a state marshal. He stated that.
Yeah.
So it's not only robbing the absentee ballots, it's impersonating individuals that he has no right to impersonate. So, you know, there's a series of violations that are alleged against him. And it's not only him, there's others that are violating the law too. And if we believe in the sanctity of the ballot box, if we believe in fair elections, and I know that's the hue and cry right now across the country, saving democracy, if that's the case, then people that are convicted of these crimes have to do jail time. And I can assure you, once that happens, Paul, things will start changing. But until that happens, they feel they have a free card to do whatever they want, whenever they want to do it. And in this particular case, apparently it's over the battle for the council presidency. So when the new council seated in, I think it's December or January, a new president is going to be elected. And the two individuals that are the current incumbents in the East Side where these alleged violations took place. One of them is running again for the council presidency.
Yeah.
And from what I understand, Mr. Castillo isn't supportive of her. So he's out there to try and, you know, take the election from her. So that way she loses. And then his candidate could be the council president. This is ridiculous. You know, all the years, Paul, I've had my agreements and my disagreements with opponents.
Sure.
Based on policy.
Yeah.
But never would I go out and cheat in order to win an election. And that's what they're doing. You know, a good friend of mine repeatedly reminds me that the only way they win elections in Bridgeport is by cheating. That's the only way it happens. You know, in 1998, Paul, I was running for state representative.
Yeah.
And I had fought against two asphalt plants to be built in the city.
Okay.
In the poorest of neighborhoods, one near Seaside Park, the other one near Pleasure Beach, right?
Yeah.
And I opposed it, and the public came out, and we had hearings. Zoning hearing had over 1,300 people
wow.
at the hearing.
Wow.
Right? And we stopped them cold, right? And then it went to court because we were sued, not us, but the
yeah.
zoning board was
yeah.
sued, and the court upheld us.
Good.
So those two asphalts were never built. Well, guess what? The mayor and the town chairman walked door-to-door against me
yeah.
in a Democratic primary. And you know what? We didn't cheat on absentees, Paul. I was able to win with the help of so many people, constituents,
yeah.
labor, friends of mine. We won by 75% of the vote.
Wow.
And if I tell you, Paul, 20 to 50 absentee ballots in the entire district were cast because we didn't have to.
I know, I know.
And that's what makes it so bad here, that you get these characters now that think the only way you can win is by cheating. And so they go out and they just abuse the system. They don't give a damn about the people of Bridgeport, because if they did, they would stop doing what they're doing. And they figure this is the way to win, is to rob and to steal and,
yeah.
and to cheat.
Hey, and Chris, you're lucky you didn't end up in the asphalt.
Yeah.
Hey, what happened to Caruso? Oh, I don't know.
Well, that's a whole other story one day I'll share with
all
you.
Right. Oh, boy.
That involved
okay.
an organized crime figure, but that's another day we'll
boy.
Talk about
all
that
All right,
one.
We'll save that one for yeah. Christmas. That'll be the Christmas show. Hey, Chris,
you know, Paul,
yeah.
I always have a story. You know, the one that Will Weicker you love?
Yeah, yeah.
I always have
okay.
a story. So
all
you
right.
know that. Yeah.
In about the 2 minutes we have left, you
yeah.
said you chatted with a guy who is no real fan of the governor. He's a Democrat,
right.
and he is perceived as one of the top two or three people in the real progressive wing of the Connecticut Democratic Party. That's Hampton State Rep.
Yeah.
Josh Elliott. What did he have to say?
Well, he called me last night. I was surprised to receive the call. I know Josh, and I've spoken to him in the past. It was very nice of him to reach out to me. You know, he's trying to gain support and endorsements, and I wouldn't give him that. You know, last night I told him there's time. Let's see how things progress.
Mm-hmm.
And but he's out working, and he's you know, visiting towns throughout the state of Connecticut. The big challenge is going to be the convention where you
yeah.
have to get enough delegates. And he's also raising money now under the public financing system. He's a state rep from Hampton. He served, I think, 10 years in the legislature and decided to take on Ned Lamont. He is progressive, he's giving it a shot. You know, I always celebrate when people want to run for office, because I think that's the strength of our democracy. So I celebrate that fact. I haven't committed to him. He asked me what my thoughts were and would I commit, and at this point I'm not prepared to do that because it's early and still things are going to show. I happen to like, as I've said before, I happen to like Ned Lamont. I think he's done a fairly good job in the state.
Mm-hmm.
So, but it was nice of him to call me, and we've agreed to, in a month or two, that he'll call me again and we'll continue the conversation. But he's out working, and he's working hard from what I can see. He's got to raise enough money in order to access public financing.
Yeah.
I think he's got to raise, I think, $350,000. And he's getting there, you know, slowly but surely. And it's just going to be interesting. He seems very committed to running. You know, and I've got to tell you, to his credit, he didn't knock Lamont.
Okay.
He just disagrees with policies and positions that Lamont has taken, and you know, he feels that we need to do more for people in the state, and he stressed that to me, and he didn't, again, there wasn't any of this, visceral back and forth about Ned Lamont. And
okay.
And he's running. And I said, you know, it's going to be a fight. And he said that, you know, he likes fights. So
okay.
he enjoys that type of political campaigning. So more to come. But I just wanted to share that with you, that he is out working, and see where it all goes. You know?
Interesting. Yeah, good for him. Listen, you may not agree with somebody, but I don't like uncontested races. I don't. Chris Caruso?
That's right.
Chris, thanks, my friend. And we'll save the asphalt and cement stories for another day, okay? All right, Chris.
Take care, Paul.
Thanks. Bye-bye. Yeah, I can imagine. Shocking. Shocking. Chris was approached by organized crime in Bridgeport. I'm just stunned. All right, so we heard there was going to be a special session in September. Then they said October. Now they're saying November 11th, 12th, 13th, something like that. First we heard, well, there's going to be another housing bill in the special session. Then we heard there's not going to be a housing bill in the special session. There's not enough time. We have to do other more important things. And now, according to some reports that popped up last night, they're saying, no, wait a minute. There is a housing bill coming. See, this is the way we do things in Connecticut. As my dearly departed father used to say, half-assed. And this is all with no in real input from the Republican Party here on a bill that could directly affect the value of your home, depending upon where it is, what the zoning is, and everything. So if you're asking me, do I know what's going on here? No, I don't. Maybe our next guest does. Our friend of the station, friend of the program, Republican State Senate Leader Steve Harding joins us. Steve, I'm confused, my friend. Help me out on this, Steve. I have no idea what's going on.
Join the club. So am I. Unfortunately. But, I mean, I think, you know, you alluded to it in your open there, Paul, because I think you're exactly right. This is what you get when you get this huge, arrogant one-party rule.
Yeah.
When there's really nothing to offset the Democratic majority numbers, and they feel no need to share any ideas, to share any thoughts, to have any discussion related to, you know, what we're going to have special session for, what we're going to do. You know, I've had members that are my leadership, the mm-hmm. Republican leadership on the housing, the land use committee, that obviously has oversight over what this bill would be, begging them to please show me what your plan is so I could review it.
Mm-hmm.
And we get crickets. When you have kind of this unhealthy balance of democratic rule in government, this is the type of government you get that's not transparent, that's not working for the people necessarily to their best interest, and continues to just simply push forward exclusively their agenda. And this is what we're dealing with.
And, Steve, I'm even noticing in some of the same stories, obviously, you may be looking at, too, and the caucus may be looking at, too. You know, there are some, again, some Democratic local leaders in some high-income areas, some very nice, wondering, well, hey, again, what's in this thing here? And from what I understand, even they're being left in the dark here. The governor is making allusions to stuff. Jason Rojas in the House is making allusions to stuff, all in a bill, Steve, that is supposed to be looked at and voted on, what, in a two-day session, a three-day session? I mean, this is maddening. This sounds like romper room here.
Yes, well, it's also usurping what special session should be. So, you know, when we created our state government and the legislative session, it was specifically intended to limit our session. We're not a full-time legislature, so it was specifically designed to say you are going to meet and vote on things from this period of time, you know, generally January, February, depending on mm-hmm. the year, until May or June, depending on the year. And that is it. You can come into a special session for emergent purposes. So essentially what's being done, and the reason that's done is because when you go into special session, the rules and the procedure and the transparency surrounding bills go away.
Yep.
Because it's a totally different operation. If this were regular session and this bill was proposed, it would at least go through the proper channels. It would have a public hearing. It would be discussed in committee. There would be committee votes. It'd see the light of day for long periods of time, and then eventually we may vote on it in the chambers. This is usurping that entire process and voting on it and seeing it the first time in the chambers, it's going to be something that's going to have repercussions mm-hmm. for 169 towns throughout this state. And we're only seeing it the day that we're voting on it, and that's our last chance. It's not like you can vote on it out of committee, and then you can see it again and vote differently potentially in chambers. This is our only vote on it, and certainly not an emergency. This should be done at the very least in regular session. I think there's a reason, unfortunately, Paul, why the Democrats don't want to show you this bill, because if it were a good bill and people would like it, I would be parading it around everywhere, wouldn't you? But we're getting this hush-hush, dark of night type of dealings, which indicates to me that this bill is probably just as bad as its original form, if not maybe even worse.
Yeah, Steve, finally, do you think, and I know I'm asking, this is you're asking for your opinion, and if you don't want to answer it, I fully understand that, but is this the kind of thing, Steve, where the governor's heading into an election year, or maybe the Democrat, because, you know, a lot of them don't like Lamont. We get it. We understand that, intra-party and all that. But is this a desperation move, you think, Steve, rather than wait until just January for the short session, that there's some desperation to get something done to please the far left of the party with an election coming up next year?
I think it's more than just simply a coincidence, isn't it, Paul? And I think that there's certainly politics at play here. And it's sad that the residents of this state are forced to be involved and be implicated in policies that have nothing to do with what's in the best interest of everyone, but simply to do with intra-party politics. And we have to live with those consequences as residents of this state, because I think this is what it is. I think that, you know, obviously, as you mentioned, Governor Lamont probably feels like he needs to appease the far left wing of his party. And I think the far left wing of his party feels that they want to show some muscle and be able to pass legislation that the governor previously opposed. So I think there's a lot of inter-party politics here. We shouldn't be playing games of inter-party politics. We should be only focused on helping the people of this state.
All right. State Senate Republican Leader Steve Harding. Steve, as always, thanks. Have a happy weekend, and we'll chat
always
down the road.
Pleasure, Paul.
All right. Thank you, Steve. Thank appreciate you, it. Yep, Steve Harding of Brookfield there. Yeah, you know, a lot of people are talking about this massive report that came out yesterday, kind of a two-pronged investigation now into gambling with organized crime. I mean, when was the last time you heard the Lucchese and Genovese crime families in the news that still exists, younger generations, and a pro sports league, the NBA, now part of the investigation? I guess there were red flags raised about a prop bet that was connected to a guy, Terry Rozier, that they were already looking at, and the FBI Director Cash Patel outlined that with the investigators. Just a mess. I mean, one job you don't want to have today is NBA media person, like working in their marketing and media departments. And speaking of sports marketing, how much of an effect will this have? And what will the NBA have to do to quell anybody, you know, who's out there going, hey, see, I told you the players are on the take, or they're doing this for their friends? Joining us right now is an expert on sports marketing, Dr. Josh Short. He's a professor of sports management program with our friends at Sacred Heart University. He's consulted with numerous organizations, teams, and corporations, including ESPN, World Wrestling Entertainment, the Harlem Globetrotters, Madison Square Garden, the Bridgeport Sound Tigers. You have heard of them. Dr. Short, it's Paul here on WICC. Good afternoon. How are you?
Great. Thanks for having me, Paul. To answer your first question, I think it was probably the 1970s was the last time those names were popping out.
Right? Especially with the local news coverage around here. But yeah, we heard about it yesterday. So that was Dr. Short in connection with these high-tech fixed poker games. But the other part of this that seems to have a lot of people going, oh boy, is the controversy with Chauncey Billups, you know, the coach of the Portland Trail Blazers, guy who I think's in the Hall of Fame, and Terry Rozier. So you're a sports marketing guy. What do you think it's like in the NBA offices now?
Well, it's probably absolute chaos, but from my perspective, the interesting and really relevant area is, you know, the fact that they were using some of these guys as the face for these illegal mafia-driven fixed, you know, games, and essentially like a celebrity endorser to get people interested. Oh, these people are involved. They're luring these people in. I guess I call them suckers.
Yeah.
And they're losing the money, and then those guys are getting profits wired back to them. So that it's, you know, pretty interesting that you're using known names to attract, you know, wealthy people into that. Interesting. We did a. Oh, go ahead.
No, go ahead. Finish. I'm sorry.
I was going to say, you know, we did a national study on sports gambling the first time last year. And we're hoping to repeat it again this year at Sacred Heart.
Good. Okay.
And interestingly, the people, by and large, were sort of softening on, you know, legalized gambling. It's not as taboo. It's easy to do online. And stuff like this just shakes the foundation of, you know, public perception and public trust. I mean, everyone's like, whoa, we should have known better. People were even softening on Pete Rose.
Yeah.
Like, oh, you know, maybe we overthought things. Maybe, you know, he was a good baseball player. And then you see stuff like this and you're like, wow, this is really at the core of, you know, you're watching a game and you're like, wow, what's real and what's not?
Mm. Yeah. And Dr. Short, you've got this scenario now of, and again, a lot of people have been warning about this, politicians and experts, you know, these prop bets. And for people that don't understand, it's a proposition bet. Okay, I'm taking player A to have more than 10 rebounds, or taking player B to have under 15 points. And the allegation here, for people who aren't following this, is Terry Rozier faked an injury to, I guess, stay under, because a lot of people bet the under here. And again, you know, Dr. Short, I'm sure if you talk to 99.9% of the players, they say, I would never do that. But now, when it's in the news and it's all over the place, the leagues must be going, you know, oh, my God, here. You know, does from a marketing point of view, does Adam Silver have to come out and address this eventually? Does he have to hold a news conference?
They're already investigating, you know, on their end, and they're probably crisis control. But the interesting thing is, these guys are very wealthy people. I mean, Rozier was making, I think his salary is about $26 million. Phillips.
Yeah.
Played in the league and as a coach. I mean, these are wealthy people that are, you know, involved in this stuff. So that's kind of shocking. But yeah, the league is going to have to, you know, jump on that. But, you know, I mentioned in another interview that the NBA, you know, they have these official gambling partners in DraftKings and
FanDuel.
I mean, yeah. they're officially partnered with them. And so, you know, there's a reason why Las Vegas was the only place you could go to gamble on sports for a very long time.
Yeah.
And you start, you know, legalizing it across the country, and you have issues.
Absolutely. Thanks to Professor Josh Stewart. He is a sports marketing expert, professor in sports management at the Welch College of Business and Technology at Sacred Heart University. Professor, thank you. We appreciate it, and hopefully we can chat down the road. Appreciate the time. Thanks.
Yeah, thank you, and thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Appreciate it. Dr. Josh Stewart there. Shewart, I should say. Dr. Josh Shewart, professor of sports management at Sacred Heart University in Fairfield. And like a lot of other states, now we're looking at maybe a date where SNAP benefits could be affected by the ongoing government shutdown. Both sides showing, at least up front, no intention on compromising here. Let's check out what's going on in D.C. CBS reporter Willie James Inman joining us this afternoon. Willie, good afternoon. Thanks for joining us. Is there any light, Willie, at the end of the tunnel on this, or are both sides just like dug in, man? They're not moving.
Well, it appears that both sides are really dug in terms of the stalemate that we're seeing on Capitol Hill. Democrats want an extension of those key tax credits supporting Obamacare, while Republicans maintain that they want to pass a clean spending bill, basically kicking the can down the road, keeping funding levels at the same level for the next several weeks. Now, we saw some action in the Senate, but they failed to move forward in passing what has already passed in the House, a bill to continue to fund the government. So for the most part, no progress on moving forward on funding the government as we are well into week three now of this government shutdown.
Yeah, Willie, finally, a couple of things here. Number one, we're hearing warnings about overworked air traffic controllers because of this. And I can think of a lot of jobs I'd rather have overworked than air traffic controllers, number one. And number two, I know here in Connecticut, we're worried about losing the federal SNAP benefits on November 1. And I'm wondering, you know, geez, Willie, when if people are afraid to fly or if the branding is going to be, well, now people go hungry, is that going to move things or not around or what?
Well, we'll see. In fact, the White House tonight sent out a news release to reporters who cover the president, basically highlighting different trade groups and organizations as it relates to the airline travel industry, pilots associations, for instance, the Airlines for America, also major unions. Specifically, I'm talking about the Coalition of Airline Pilots Association, to be specific, calling on Congress to essentially get to work and pass a funding bill so that their members can get a paycheck. We, of course, know that millions of federal workers are going without a paycheck. Some are furloughed. We, of course, have seen the White House move to fire and let go some of those federal workers. So not only do you have people like air traffic controllers, TSA agents, or the people that the public, you and I, see when we go to airports. We typically don't see those air traffic controllers because they're up in the air traffic control tower, of course. But these are individuals that have to work. They're required to work, and now they're working without a paycheck. And certainly you could see down the road other programs, SNAP benefits, other programs be affected by a lapse in government funding. And so you're seeing the White House pointing the finger at Democrats. Democrats say that they want to make sure that Americans have key health care coverage. But the president, for his part, staying a little bit far away from the negotiations with both sides, although he has been speaking with members of Capitol Hill, Republican members to be exact. He hasn't had a leader-wide meeting as he did at the White House several weeks ago to discuss this government shutdown. He's getting ready to head on to a trip to Asia to meet with world leaders. But I anticipate the president will still have lots to say. And he can always pick up the phone and talk with leaders up on Capitol Hill. But still, nonetheless, millions of government employees going without pay as the shutdown continues.
CBS News reporter Willie James Inman covering the White House. Willie, thank you. Have a safe weekend. We appreciate it. Thank you.
All right. You bet. Thank you.
Appreciate it. There you go, folks. Back at it right here on Connecticut Today, WICC 600 AM, 95.9 FM, and, of course, online streaming for all those digital devices at voiceofct.com. Very pleased to have our next guest with us. He's an award-winning historian, a writer, a conservationist, international public servant, the author of four books. His writing has been featured in many publications, including the Financial Times and the New York Times. He has a brand new book out, and this book is fascinating. Peacemaker, Uthant, and the Forgotten Quest for a Just World. The author and grandson of Uthant joins us, Thant Minh Uthant. It's Paul here at WICC. Glad to have you with us. How are you, sir?
Very well, thank you. Good to be with you today.
And you told me right before we got going here that you are somewhat familiar with the Fairfield County area where we are.
That's right, because my parents, my father's passed away a few years ago. My mother has moved to somewhere near Boston, but they were both living together in Westport, for, I guess, about 15 years altogether until a few years ago.
Fabulous. You know, when I was growing up and I was transfixed by news, along with all the Saturday morning cartoons, but I was able to gather that the news wasn't really entertainment. It was what was really happening. And your grandfather, Uthant, served as the third ever Secretary General of the UN. Right when I was growing up, in fact, I was born in 1961. He served 10 years, 1961 to 1971. When did you first become cognizant, Thant, of the impact and the grandeur of the position that your grandfather had?
I guess in bits and pieces. I mean, we lived with him, my parents, and so me and my sisters, we lived with him. I was born in his house, not in his house, but in the hospital, but lived with him as a young child in Riverdale, in the Bronx,
sure,
where he was Secretary General. So I was born in 66. And we would occasionally, or I would very occasionally, go with him or visit him in his office on the top floor of the UN building in Manhattan. And one of my earliest memories is actually going, it was in 1970, so I was just about 4 years old, and to go visit the Apollo 11 astronauts who were, coming to see him,
sure,
a year after they had come back from the moon. So I kind of realized he was in a special position, but it was only much later on that I tried to understand what his role had been and the legacy of his time in office.
I guess it hit you, yeah, grandpa or grandfather or however you referred to him, he had a pretty big job. Even you were able at a young age to figure that out, huh?
Yeah, that's right. I remember his car. I remember a siren that was inside the car that you would put on top of the car. I guess if there was ever a global emergency, I remember his security guards and the guards we had at the house. So those things are kind of fuzzy memories for me. But then for a long time, I didn't really think about his time and his time as Secretary General. I worked for the UN for a while, but he had faded into the background. Very few people talked about him. Younger generation of people, the UN didn't know very much about him. So, you know, even though I had worked in the UN and I'm a historian, I'd worked on British Empire, much older kind of history, it's only with this book that I really began to kind of dive into what actually happened. And also this question of why it's been largely forgotten as well.
So let's get to that, Thanta. Again, he served in a very turbulent time, November of 61, I see, to December of 71, so roughly about 10 years. And you began looking into this, and in your research, I would imagine, what impacted you? Were there things that were like, oh, wow, moments here about your grandfather and about what he was trying to do, as you say, his quest for peace?
Yes, from the very beginning, because I wasn't intending to write this book, but the UN had declassified over the years, but also digitized his archive. So that wasn't just his official papers, but it was also his personal papers, which my family had given to the UN. So hotel receipts, medical records, you know, personal letters, everything. And because they had digitized them over COVID, I began to look through them and suddenly realized that it was very different from the kind of history things that I'd read in the history books. So I went to the library, I read everything I could on the Cuban Missile Crisis, Vietnam, Six-Day War. And I realized it was a very different story that was in that archive. And so that was the beginning of my research and my work into this book.
You mentioned one aspect, the Cuban Missile Crisis, all the things, Thant, that went on there. Were you able to find out or glean that your grandfather, in his quest for peace, was he more involved, or was there a different, perhaps, level of involvement in some of these international crises or ongoing dealings between nations that maybe a lot of people didn't know about or not?
Yeah, absolutely. Because I think what, you know, the story that's told, and the story that's even in, you know, almost all the history books, even up to the present day, certainly all the movies and TV shows that you might watch, is that there was a Cuban Missile Crisis. President Kennedy sort of stood firm. He was very skillful, and the Russians backed down. And in almost none of those accounts do you read about a Burmese UN Secretary General who was the mediator in between Kennedy and the Soviet leader, Nikita Khrushchev. But that's exactly what happened. And over those many days, I mean, he both inserted himself into the crisis. He basically sent a whole series of both public and also secret messages to both sides to help create the kind of time and space for that emergency diplomacy of several days. He came out with the formula. Actually, he was the first to articulate the formula for the settlement of the conflict. He flew to Havana to see Fidel Castro to try to get him on side. He negotiated between the two sides on the verification of the Soviet missile withdrawal. So all of that meant that he, as the kind of neutral person in between, that all three sides, I mean, Castro as well, could kind of eventually depend on and use in different ways to pull themselves back from the brink, he played a really indispensable role. And it's fascinating to both look at the archive, and I hope the story that I tell will be of interest to a lot of people as well.
Thant Minh U is the guest. His grandfather, of course, U Thant, the name of the book by Thant, Peacemaker, U Thant and the Forgotten Quest for a Just World. Boy, to get involved, Thant, in that, in a situation where the world was a few days, possibly, tragically, from going to World War III, but he was able, as you say, to get both sides in some way to step back. It's got to take a special kind of of person to do that. And you title the book Peacemaker. Was he, in fact, a natural peacemaker? What brought him briefly to that to the heights of what he was able to achieve? What was that like?
Yeah, I mean, it's a remarkable story because he arrived in New York in 1957, so a few years before, to be the Burmese ambassador. And he quickly gained the reputation as the guy who kind of got along with everyone from East and West and from the colonial, ex-colonial world and from the Western powers as well. But just 10 years before that, he was actually living in essentially a village, a small town in Burma, very poor country, very poor place. He was a school teacher for almost his entire life until he was 40 years old. And then he decides on a midlife career change, leaves, goes to Rangoon, the capital of Burma, rises in the government service, and then winds up in New York. And a few years later, becomes the head of the UN and is mediating between Kennedy and Khrushchev. And I think part of it was he had a very cool temper. He was a very even sort of tempered person. But I think his special power, in a way, was he had lived in many different worlds. So I think he was a good listener, and he was very good at understanding many different points of view and trying to identify exactly where the areas of compromise could be, or where he could try to get different sides to move forward on very thorny issues.
There have been multiple secretaries general of the UN. What do you think your grandfather's legacy was at the UN for his roughly 10-year tenure? If you talk to a UN historian like yourself, what do you think they say when your grandfather's name is mentioned?
I think one thing is, in those days, I mean, the UN is very actively mediating in lots of conflicts. So he mediated in over a dozen different conflicts. Some were successful, some were unsuccessful. Vietnam was a huge frustration for him for many years. But I think overarching all of those things was that over that 10-year period, the world was decolonized, and all these new countries from Asia and Africa came into the UN and basically created the international system that we have today. We kind of think that the system was created in 45 at the end of World War II, but actually most aspects of the system that we have centered on the UN to some extent, with states being at least nominally equal, that's very much a product of the 1960s. And that wasn't set in stone when he took charge in 61. It was still very half finished. But by the time he left in 71, the UN was around. It had kind of stabilized in many ways. And we have this post-colonial system that we didn't have just a couple of decades before.
Finally, fast forward to where we are now, Thornton, in October of 2025, and the UN still has some very strong backers. The UN has some moderate backers, and then the UN has some critics in various countries, including at times our present occupant of the White House, Mr. Trump, who doesn't see the strength of the UN. They want the UN to do more. Some people tragically look at it as powerless. What are your thoughts on that? Is the UN kind of an always evolving body, depending upon what's going on in the world?
Yes, it's always an evolving body, and the UN is very different in each decade, and it's had to reinvent itself. And in a way, I think the critics of the UN can sometimes be right. I think it's not doing the job that it should be doing in ending many of the terrible wars that we see around the world. It's not really set up right now to respond to something like the Cuban Missile Crisis. If we have an accidental escalation, possible nuclear confrontation, say between the U.S. and China or Russia and Europe, I don't think the UN is set up to play the kind of role that my grandfather was able to play in 1962. So I think we have to take a really hard look at the UN. At the same time, it has this tremendous record of success and failure for 70, 80 years. So we should learn from that and see what it's actually good at and what it's not. And finally, I think that, you know, it's the only global institution that we actually have, the only universal institution where every country is a member. So we definitely shouldn't throw it away. I think we need a lot of hard thinking, homework, and political investment to make it that kind of peacemaking institution that it has been at different times, and I think it can be in the future as well.
And the name of the book is Peacemaker, U Thant and the Forgotten Quest for a Just World, written by U Thant's grandson, Thant Minh U. Thant, thank you. This has been fascinating. Continue good luck, and may the spirit of your grandfather live on. We really appreciate it. Thank you.
Thanks very much. Bye-bye.